However, tell her, if you'll be so kind, that I am appointed member of the committee of the joint... Oh, but she will understand. You know, les petites misères de la vie humaine, he said to the princess, as if to excuse himself. And the Princess Mayakaya, not Lisa, but Bibish, is really sending 1,000 rifles and 12 nurses. Did I tell you?
Yes, I have heard, replied Koznishev, reluctantly.
What a pity you're going away, said Oblonsky. Tomorrow we're giving a dinner to two of those who are going to the war, Dmitry Bartnyansky from Petersburg and our Veslovsky, Vasenka. They are both going. Veslovsky married recently, a fine fellow. Isn't he, Princess? He added, turning to the lady.
The Princess, without replying, glanced at Koznishev. But the fact that Koznishev and the Princess seemed to wish to get rid of him did not abash Oblonsky in the least. He looked smilingly, now at the feather on the princess's bonnet, and now about him, as if trying to remember something. Noticing a lady with a collecting box, he beckoned to her and put in a 5-ruble note.
"I can't look calmly at those collecting boxes while I have any money," he remarked. "And what a telegram that was today! Fine fellows, those Montenegrins!" "You don't say so!" he exclaimed, when the princess told him that Vronsky was going by that train.
For a moment Oblonsky's face looked sad. But a minute later, when, with a slight spring in his step and smoothing his whiskers, he entered the waiting room where Vronsky was, Oblonsky had quite forgotten how he had sobbed with despair over his sister's corpse, and he saw in Vronsky only a hero and an old friend.
"With all his faults, one must do him justice," the princess said to Koznishev as soon as Oblonsky had left them. "His is a thoroughly Russian, Slavonic nature.
Only I'm afraid it will be painful for Vronsky to see him. Say what you will. That man's fate touches me."
"Have a talk with him on the journey," said the princess.
"Yes, I might, if opportunity offers."
"I never liked him, but this atones for much. Not only is he going himself, but he is taking a whole squadron at his own expense."
"So I heard."
The bell rang. Everybody thronged toward the door.
"There he is," said the princess, pointing to Vronsky, who, in a long overcoat and a black, broad-brimmed hat, was passing with his mother on his arm.
Oblonsky walked beside him, talking with animation. Vronsky was frowning and looking straight before him, as if not hearing what Oblonsky was saying. Probably at Oblonsky's indication, he looked round to where Koznishev and the princess were standing and silently raised his hat. His face, which was aged and full of suffering, seemed petrified. Coming up to the train, Vronsky, letting his mother pass before him, silently disappeared into one of the compartments. On the platform, "God Save the Tsar" was struck up, followed by "Hurrah" and "Shavio!" One of the volunteers, a tall, hollow-chested, very young man, was bowing in a specially noticeable way, waving over his head a felt hat and a bouquet. From behind him, two officers and an elderly man with a large beard and a greasy cap thrust their heads out and also bowed.
Chapter 3. Having taken leave of the princess, Koznishev, with Katavasov, who had joined him, entered the very crowded carriage, and the train started. At the Tsaritsino station, the train was met by a melodious choir of young people singing Slavia. Again the volunteers bowed and thrust their heads out, but Koznishev did not pay attention to them. He had had so much to do with volunteers that he was already familiar with their general type, and it did not interest him. Katavasov, however, whose scientific occupations had offered him no opportunities of studying the volunteers, was much interested in them and questioned Koznishev about them. Koznishev advised him to go into the second-class carriage and have a talk with some of them. At the next station, Katavasov followed this advice. As soon as the train stopped, he changed carriages and made acquaintance with the volunteers. They were sitting in a corner, talking loudly, evidently aware that the attention of their fellow passengers and of Katavasov, who had just entered, was directed toward them. The tall, hollow-chested young man talked louder than any of them. He was evidently drunk and was speaking of something that had happened at his school. Opposite him sat an officer, no longer young, wearing a military jacket of the Austrian guards. He listened smilingly to the young man and tried to stop him. The third volunteer, wearing an artillery uniform, sat beside them on a trunk. A fourth one was asleep. Getting into conversation with the young man, Katavasov learnt that he had been a rich Moscow merchant, but had run through a large fortune before he was 22. Katavasov did not like him because he was effeminate, spoilt, and delicate. He was evidently sure, especially now that he was tipsy, that he was performing an heroic deed, and he bragged most unpleasantly. Another, a retired officer, also produced an unpleasant impression on Katavasov. He was, apparently, a man who had tried everything. He had had a post on the railway, been a steward, and had started factories, and he talked about it all quite needlessly, using inappropriate technical terms. But Katavasov liked the third, an artilleryman, very much. He was a modest, quiet man, who evidently deferred to the knowledge of the retired guardsman and to the heroic self-sacrifice of the merchant, and did not talk at all about himself. When Katavasov asked him what prompted him to go to Serbia, he modestly replied, "Well, everybody is going. One must help the Serbs. One's sorry for them." "Yes, it's particularly artillerymen they're short of," said Katavasov. "But I have not served long in the artillery. Perhaps they'll put me in the infantry or cavalry." "Why into the infantry when they need artillerymen most of all?" said Katavasov, concluding from the artilleryman's age that he must have risen to a considerable rank. "I did not serve in the artillery long. I am a retired cadet," he said, and began to explain why he had not passed the examination for a commission. All this put together produced on Katavasov a disagreeable impression, and when the volunteers got out at the station to have a drink, he wished to verify this unfavourable impression by a talk with somebody. One of the passengers, an old man in a military overcoat, had been listening all the time to Katavasov's conversation with the volunteers. When they were left alone together, Katavasov addressed him. "What a variety there is in the positions of all these men who are going there," Katavasov remarked vaguely, wishing to express his own opinion, but at the same time to draw the old man. The old soldier had been through two campaigns. He knew what a military man ought to be, and by the appearance and talk of those men, and by the swagger with which they applied themselves to their flasks on the way, he considered them bad soldiers. Besides that, he lived in a provincial town and wanted to speak of a discharged soldier of his town who had volunteered, a drunkard and thief whom no one would employ any longer. But, knowing by experience that in the present state of public feeling it was dangerous to express any opinion contrary to the prevailing one, and especially dangerous to censure the volunteers, he also watched Katavasov. "Well, men are wanted there," he said, with laughing eyes. And they began talking about the latest war news, each concealing from the other his perplexity as to whom tomorrow's battle was to be with, since the Turks, according to the latest intelligence, had been beaten at all points. And so they parted without either of them having expressed his opinion. Katavasov, returning to his carriage, involuntarily prevaricated, and in telling Koznishev his observations of the volunteers, let it appear that they were excellent fellows. At the station of a big town, the volunteers were again greeted with songs and cheers. Again women and men turned up with collecting boxes, the provincial ladies presented nosegays and accompanied the volunteers to the refreshment bar. But all this was far feebler and weaker than in Moscow. Chapter 4. When the train stopped at the provincial capital, Koznishev, instead of going to the refreshment room, walked up and down the platform. The first time he passed the Vronsky's compartment, he noticed that the blind was down. But the next time he passed, he saw the old countess at the window. She beckoned to him.
"You see, I am going with him as far as Kursk," said she.
"Yes, so I heard," replied Koznishev, stopping by her window and glancing inside. "What a fine action this is of his," he added, noticing that Vronsky was not there.
"Yes, but after his misfortune, what could he do?"
"What a dreadful occurrence," remarked Koznishev.
"Oh, what I have endured! But come in.
"Oh, what I have endured," she repeated when Koznishev had entered and taken a seat beside her. "You cannot imagine it. For 6 weeks he spoke to no one, and ate only when I implored him to. One could not leave him a moment alone. We took away everything that he could kill himself with. We lived on the ground floor, but one could not tell what he might do. You know he had once before shot himself on her account," she said, and the old woman's brows knit at the recollection. Yes, she ended as such a woman deserved to end. Even the death she chose was mean and low. "It is not for us to judge, Countess," Koznishev remarked with a sigh. "But I understand how distressing it was for you."
"Oh, don't speak of it. I was living on my estate, and he was with me. A note was brought. He wrote an answer and sent it off.
We had no idea that she was herself there at the station.
In the evening I had only just gone to my room when my Maria told me that at the station a lady had thrown herself under a train. I felt as if I had received a blow. I knew it was she. The first thing I said was, 'Don't tell him.' But he'd already been told. His coachman had been there and saw it all. When I ran to his room, he was beside himself. It was terrible to see him. He did not say a word, but off he galloped to the station. I don't know what happened there, but they brought him back like a corpse. I should not have known him. 'Prostration complète,' the doctor said. Then came raving madness, almost. Oh, one can't speak of it," exclaimed the Countess with a gesture of her arm. "A terrible time. No, say what you will, she was a bad woman.
Such desperate passions.
Only to prove something unusual. Well, she proved it. She ruined herself and 2 splendid men. Her husband and my unfortunate son."
"And how about her husband?" inquired Koznishev.
"He took our little girl.
Alexei at first agreed to everything, but now he is greatly distressed at having given up his daughter to a stranger.
But he can't go back on his word."
"Karenin came to the funeral, but we tried to arrange so that he and Alexei should not meet. For him, the husband, it is better. She has set him free."
"But my poor son had given himself up to her entirely. He had thrown up everything, his career, me. And then she did not even pity him, but deliberately dealt him a death blow."
"No, say what you will, her death itself was the death of a horrid woman, without religion. God forgive me.
I cannot help hating her memory when I see my son's ruin."
"But how is he now?"
"It is a God-sent help for us, this Serbian war. I am an old woman and understand nothing about it, but for him it is a godsend.
Of course, I, as his mother, fear for him.
And above all, I hear that ce n'est pas très bien vu à Petersburg, but
it can't be helped. It was the only thing that could rouse him.
His friend, Yashvin, had lost everything at cards and was going to Serbia. He came to see him and persuaded him to go.
Now it interests him. Please, have a talk with him. I want him to have some distraction.
He's so sad. Unluckily, too, his teeth have started aching. But he will be very glad to see you. Please, have a talk with him. He is walking about on the other side."
Koznishev said he would be very pleased, and crossed over to the other platform. Chapter 5. In the slanting shadow of a pile of sacks heaped up on the platform, Vronsky, in a long overcoat, his hat pulled down low and his hands in his pockets, was walking up and down like an animal in a cage, turning sharply every 20 paces. To Koznishev, as he approached, it seemed that Vronsky saw, but pretended not to see him. But Koznishev did not care. He was above any personal considerations with Vronsky. In his eyes, Vronsky at that moment seemed an important worker in a great cause, and Koznishev considered it his duty to encourage and cheer him. He went up to him. Vronsky paused, looked at Koznishev, recognized him, and advancing a few steps to meet him, pressed his hand very, very hard. "Perhaps you did not wish to see me," said Koznishev. "But can I not be of some use to you?"
"There is no one whom it would be less unpleasant for me to meet than yourself," returned Vronsky. "Excuse me. There is nothing that is pleasant in life for me."
"I understand. And I wanted to offer you my services," said Koznishev, gazing into Vronsky's face, which bore evident signs of suffering.
"Do you not want a letter to Rishtik or to Milan?" "Oh, no," replied Vronsky, as if it cost him an effort to understand. "If you don't mind, let us walk up and down. It is so stuffy in the carriage." "A letter? No, thank you. No introductions are needed to enable one to die. Unless, indeed, to the Turks," he added, smiling with his lips only.
His eyes retained their expression of angry suffering.
"Yes, but it may be easier for you to establish connections, which will be necessary anyway, with someone who has been prepared. However, as you please."
"I was very glad to hear of your decision. The volunteers are being very much attacked, and a man like yourself will raise them in public opinion."
"As a man, I have this quality, that I do not value my life at all, and that I have physical energy enough to hack my way into a square and slay or fall. That I am sure of. I am glad that there is something for which I can lay down the life which I not only do not want, but of which I am sick. It will be of use to somebody."
And he moved his jaw impatiently, because of the incessant, gnawing pain in his tooth, which even prevented him from speaking with the expression he desired. "You will recover, I prophesy it," said Koznishev, feeling touched. "To free one's brothers from oppression is an aim worth both dying and living for. God grant you outward success and inward peace," he added, holding out his hand. Vronsky grasped the hand warmly.
"Yes, as a tool I may be of some use. But as a man, I am a ruin," said he, pausing between the words.
The acute pain in the strong tooth, filling his mouth with saliva, hindered his speaking. He remained silent, gazing at the wheels of the approaching tender, which was slowly and smoothly gliding over the rails. Suddenly a quite different feeling, not of pain, but of tormenting inward discomfort, made him for a moment forget his toothache. At the sight of the tender and the rails, and under the influence of conversation with someone he had not met since the catastrophe, he suddenly remembered her. That is, remembered what was left of her when, like a madman, he ran into the railway shed where, on a table, stretched out shamelessly before the eyes of strangers, lay the mangled body still warm with recent life. The head, left intact, with its heavy plaits and the curls round the temples, was thrown back. And on the lovely face with its half-open red lips was frozen an expression, pitiful on the lips, and horrible in the fixed, open eyes. An expression which repeated, as if in words, the terrible phrase about his repenting it, which she had uttered during their quarrel. He tried to remember her as she was when he had met her the first time, also at a railway station. Mysterious, charming, loving, seeking and giving joy, and not cruelly vindictive as he remembered her at the last. He tried to recall his best moments with her, but they were forever poisoned. He could think of her only as triumphant, having carried out the threat of inflicting on him totally useless but irrevocable remorse.
He ceased to feel the pain in his tooth, and sobs distorted his face. Having twice walked past the sacks and mastered himself, he turned calmly to Koznishev.
"You have not seen any telegram later than yesterday's?"
"Yes, they have been beaten a third time. But a decisive battle is expected tomorrow."
And having spoken about the proposed proclamation of Milan as king and of the immense results this might have, they returned to their respective carriages after the second bell had already sounded.
Chapter 6. As he had not known when he would be able to leave Moscow, Koznishev had not sent a telegram to his brother asking to be met at the station, and Lievin was not at home when, toward noon, Katavasov and Koznishev, dark as Arabs with the dust in the little tarantass they had hired at the station, drew up at the porch of the Pokrovsk house. Kitty, who was sitting on the balcony with her father and sister, recognized her brother-in-law and ran down to meet him.
"Aren't you ashamed of yourself for not letting us know?" she said, holding out her hand to him and offering her forehead for a kiss.
"We got here first rate without troubling you," replied Koznishev. "I am so dusty that I dare not touch you. I was so busy that I did not know when I could tear myself away. And you, as usual," said he, smiling, "are enjoying tranquil happiness outside the currents in your peaceful shallows. And here is our friend, Theodor Vasilyevich, who has come at last."
"But I am not a negro. When I have had a wash, I shall look like a human being," Katavasov said, in his usual jesting way, holding out his hand and smiling, his teeth looking particularly bright in contrast with his black face.
"Kostya will be so pleased. He has gone to the farm. It is time he was back."
"Always busy with his husbandry. In the shallows, hits it exactly," remarked Katavasov.
"And we in town can see nothing but the Serbian war."
"Well, and what does my friend think of it? Surely not the same as other people."
"Oh, nothing in particular. The same as everybody," Kitty answered, rather embarrassed, and glancing round at Koznishev. "Well, I'll send for him. Papa is staying with us. He has not long returned from abroad."
And having arranged that Lievin should be sent for, and that the dusty visitors should be shown where to wash, one of them in Lievin's study and the other in Dolly's former room, and about lunch for them, Kitty, exercising the right of moving quickly of which she had been deprived during pregnancy, ran up the balcony stairs.
"It's Sergei Ivanich and Katavasov, the professor," said she.
"Oh, how trying in this heat," said the prince.
"No, Papa, he's very nice, and Kostya is very fond of him," Kitty replied with a smile as of entreaty, having noticed a sarcastic expression on her father's face.
"I don't mind."
"You go and entertain them, dear," Kitty said to her sister. "They met Stiva at the station. He is quite well, and I will run to Mitya. As ill luck will have it, I have not fed him since breakfast. He will be awake now and is certainly screaming." And feeling the flow of milk, she went with rapid steps to the nursery. It was not a mere guess. The bond between herself and the baby had not yet been severed, and she knew surely by the flow of milk within herself that he was wanting food. She knew he was screaming before she reached the nursery, and so he was. She heard his voice and increased her speed, but the faster she went, the louder he screamed. It was a fine, healthy voice, only hungry and impatient.
"Has he been screaming long, nurse?"
"Long?" she asked, hurriedly, sitting down and preparing to nurse the baby.
"Be quick and give him to me." "Oh, nurse, how tiresome you are. Come, you can tie up his cap afterwards."
The baby was convulsed with hungry yells.
"But one must, you know, ma'am," said Agafya Mikhailovna, who was almost always in the nursery. "He must be properly tidied up."
"Goo, goo," she cooed to him, paying no attention to the mother.
The nurse brought the baby to his mother, and Agafya Mikhailovna followed behind, her face softened with tenderness.
"He knows me. He does. It's God's truth, Katrina Alexandrovna, dear. He knows me," said Agafya Mikhailovna, raising her voice above the baby's.
But Kitty did not listen. Her impatience was increasing with the babies. As a result of their impatience, matters were long in getting settled. The baby got hold in the wrong place and was angry.
At last, after desperate screaming and choking, matters went smoothly, and both mother and child felt calmed and were silent.
"But he too, poor mite, is all in a perspiration," whispered Kitty, feeling him with her hand. "Why do you think he knows you?" she added, moving her eyes so as to see the babies.
They looked roguishly at her, she thought, from beneath his cap, which had slipped forward, and she watched the rhythmical rise and fall of his cheeks, and the little hand with the rosy palm making circular movements.
"It's impossible. If he knew anyone, it would be me," Kitty replied to Agafya Mikhailovna's statement, and smiled.
She smiled because, though she said it was impossible for him to know, she was sure in her heart that he not only knew Agafya Mikhailovna, but that he knew and understood everything, even many things that no one else knew, and which she, his mother, had learnt to know and understand through him. For Agafya Mikhailovna, for the nurse, for his grandfather, and even for his father, Mitya was a living being requiring only material care. But for his mother he had already long been a moral being, with whom she had already had a long series of spiritual relations.
"Well, wait till he wakes up and you will see for yourself. When I do like that, he quite brightens up, the dear. He brightens up like a sunny morning," said Agafya Mikhailovna.
"Well, all right, we shall see," Kitty whispered. "But now go away, he's falling asleep."
Chapter 7 Agafya Mikhailovna went out on tiptoe. The nurse pulled down the blind, drove away the flies from under the muslin curtain of the cot, and also a bumblebee that was buzzing against the windowpane, and sat down, waving a birch branch above the mother and child.
"Oh, the heat, the heat! If God would only send a little rain," she said. "Yes, yes, hush," was all Kitty answered, as she sat softly rocking herself and tenderly pressing the little plump arm, which looked as if a thread had been tied round the wrist, and was still feebly waving while Mitya kept shutting and opening his eyes. This hand disturbed Kitty. She wanted to kiss it, but was afraid to do so lest she should wake her baby. At last the arm ceased waving and the eyes closed. Only now and then the baby, continuing his business, lifted his long, curved lashes and looked at his mother with moist eyes that seemed black in the dim light. The nurse stopped waving the branch and began to doze. From upstairs was heard the roll of the prince's voice and of Katavasov's laughter.
"I expect they've got into conversation in my absence," thought Kitty. "But all the same, it's provoking that Kostya is away. I expect he's gone to the apiary again, though I am sorry that he goes there so often. Yet I'm also glad of it. It is a distraction for him. He is more cheerful now than he was in spring. Then he was so gloomy and suffered so much that I was becoming alarmed about him. And how funny he is," she whispered with a smile.
She knew what was tormenting her husband. It was his want of faith. Although, had she been asked whether she thought that if he did not believe in the future life he would perish, she would have had to acknowledge that he would, yet his lack of faith did not make her unhappy. And she, who accepted the doctrine that salvation was impossible for an unbeliever, while loving her husband's soul more than anything in the world, smiled when she thought of his disbelief and called him funny.
"Why has he been reading those philosophies for a whole year?" she thought.
"If it's all written in those books, he can understand it.
If what they say is untrue, why read them? He says himself that he would like to believe. Then why does he not believe? It must be because he thinks too much. And he thinks too much because of his solitude. He's always alone, alone. He can't talk to us about everything. I think he will be glad of these visitors, especially of Katavasov. He likes arguing with them," she reflected, and then turned her mind to the problem of where she had better arrange for Katavasov to sleep, in a separate room or with Koznishev. And here a thought suddenly struck her, which made her start with excitement and even disturb Mitya,
who gave her a severe look in consequence.
"I don't think the laundress has brought the things back, and the spare sheets are all in use. If I don't see to it, Agafya Mikhailovna will give Sergei Ivanovich used bed linen."
And the very thought of this sent the blood into Kitty's face. "Yes, I must see about it," she decided. And returning to her former train of thought, she remembered that there was something important, something spiritual, that she had not yet thought out, and tried to recollect what it was. "Oh, yes, Kostya is an unbeliever," she thought again with a smile. "Well, he is an unbeliever. Better let him be that than be like Madame Stahl, or like what I wanted to be when I was abroad. No, he will never pretend." Then a recent proof of his kindness came vividly to her mind. 2 weeks before, Dolly had received a penitent letter from her husband. He implored her to save his honour and to sell her estate to pay his debts. Dolly was in despair. She hated her husband, despised him, pitied him, made up her mind to divorce him and to refuse, but ended by consenting to sell part of her estate. With an involuntary smile of emotion, Kitty remembered her own husband's shamefacedness after that, and his repeated, awkward attempts to approach the subject he had on his mind, and how at length, having discovered the only way of helping Dolly without offending her, he suggested to Kitty that she should give her sister her own part of the estate, a device that had not occurred to her. "How can he be an unbeliever with such a heart? And his dread of hurting anybody's feelings, even a child's. Everything for others, nothing for himself. Sergei Ivanovich quite regards it as Kostya's duty to act as his steward, and so does his sister. And now Dolly and her children are his wards. And then there are all those peasants who come to him every day as if it were his business to help them. Yes, only be like your father. Only be like him," she whispered, giving Mitya to the nurse and touching his cheek with her lips. Chapter 8. Since the moment when, at the sight of his beloved and dying brother, Lievin for the first time looked at the questions of life and death in the light of the new convictions, as he called them, which between the ages of 20 and 34 had imperceptibly replaced the beliefs of his childhood and youth, he had been less horrified by death than by life, without the least knowledge of whence it came, what it is for, why, and what it is. Organisms, their destruction, the indestructibility of matter, the law of the conservation of energy, development, the terms that had superseded these beliefs were very useful for mental purposes, but they gave no guidance for life. And Lievin suddenly felt like a person who has exchanged a thick fur coat for a muslin garment, and who, being out in the frost for the first time, becomes clearly convinced, not by arguments, but with the whole of his being, that he is as good as naked, and that he must inevitably perish miserably. From that moment, without thinking about it, and though he continued living as he had done heretofore, Lievin never ceased to feel afraid of his ignorance. Moreover, he was vaguely conscious that what he had called his convictions were really ignorance, and more than that, were a state of mind which rendered knowledge of what he needed impossible. At the commencement of his married life, the new joys and new duties he experienced completely stifled these thoughts. But lately, since his wife's confinement, while living in Moscow without any occupation, the problem demanding solution had presented itself more and more insistently to him. For him, the problem was this: if I don't accept the replies offered by Christianity to the questions my life presents, what solutions do I accept? And he not only failed to find in the whole arsenal of his convictions any kind of answer, but he could not even find anything resembling an answer. He was in the position of a man seeking for food in a toy shop or at a gunsmith's. Involuntarily and unconsciously, in every book, in every conversation, and in every person he met, He now sought for their relation to those questions and for a solution to them. What astounded and upset him most in this connection was that the majority of those in his set and of his age, having, like himself, replaced their former beliefs by new convictions like his own, did not see anything to be distressed about and were quite contented and tranquil. So that, besides the principal question, Lievin was tormented by other questions. Were these people sincere? Were they not pretending? Or did they understand, possibly in some different and clearer way than he, the answers science gives to the questions he was concerned with? And he studied painstakingly both the opinions of those people and the books which contained their answers. One thing he had discovered since these questions had begun to occupy him, namely, that he had been mistaken in imagining from his recollections of his youthful university circle that religion had outlived its day and no longer existed. All those near to him who lived good lives were people who believed. The old prince, Lyovov, of whom he had grown so fond, his brother, Koznishev, and all the womenfolk. His wife believed as he had done in early childhood, and 99 out of 100 of the Russian people, the whole of the people whose lives he most respected, also believed. Another thing was that, having read a great many books, he became convinced that those who shared his outlook understood only what he had understood, explaining nothing and merely ignoring those problems without a solution to which he felt he could not live, but trying to solve quite other problems which could not interest him, such as, for instance, the development of organisms, a mechanical explanation of the soul, and so on. Besides, during the time of his wife's confinement, an extraordinary thing had happened to him. He, an unbeliever, began to pray, and while praying, believed. But that moment had passed, and he could not allot any place in his life to the state of mind he had then experienced. He could not admit that he had then known the truth and was now making a mistake, because as soon as he reflected calmly about it, it all fell to pieces. Nor could he acknowledge that he had then been mistaken, for he prized the state his soul had then been in, and by acknowledging it to be a result of weakness, he would have defiled those moments. He was painfully out of harmony with himself, and strained all his spiritual powers to escape from this condition. Chapter 9. These thoughts oppressed and tormented him, now more and now less strongly, but never left him. He read and thought, and the more he read and thought, the further he felt from his goal. Latterly, in Moscow and in the country, having convinced himself that he could get no answer from the materialists, he read through and reread Plato, Spinoza, Kant, Schelling, Hegel, and Schopenhauer, those philosophers who explained life otherwise than materialistically. Their thoughts seemed to him fruitful when he read, or was himself devising refutations of other teachings, the materialistic in particular. But as soon as he began reading, or himself devised solutions to life's problems, the same thing occurred every time. Following long definitions of vague words such as spirit, will, freedom, substance, and deliberately entering the verbal trap set for him by the philosophers or by himself, he seemed to begin to understand something. But he had only to forget that artificial line of thought and to return direct from real life to what had appeared satisfactory so long as he kept to the given line of thought, and suddenly the whole artificial edifice tumbled down like a house of cards, and it was evident that the edifice had been constructed of those same words differently arranged, and without regard for something in life more important than reason. At one time, while reading Schopenhauer, he replaced the word will by the word love, and this new philosophy comforted him for a day or two, as long as he did not stand aside from it. But it, too, collapsed when he viewed it in relation to real life, and it turned out to be a muslin garment without warmth. His brother Koznishev advised him to read Homyakov's theological writings. Levin read the second volume of them, and, in spite of its polemical, polished, and witty style, which at first repelled him, he was struck by its teaching about the Church. He was struck by the thought that it is not given to isolated man to attain divine truth, but that it is given to a community united by love, the Church. He was pleased by the thought that it was easier to believe in an existing, living Church which compounds all the beliefs of men and has God at its head and is therefore holy and infallible, and from it to accept belief in God, a distant, mysterious God, the creation, and so on. But afterwards, on reading the history of the Church, first by a Roman Catholic and then by a Greek Orthodox writer, and finding that each essentially infallible Church repudiated the other, he became disenchanted with Homyakov's teaching about the Church, and that edifice fell into dust, just as the philosophical structures had done. All that spring he was not himself and experienced terrible moments. "Without knowing what I am and why I am here, it is impossible to live. Yet I cannot know that, and therefore I can't live," he said to himself. "In an infinity of time and in infinity of matter, in infinite space, a bubble organism, separates itself, and that bubble maintains itself a while, and then bursts, and that bubble is I." This was a distressing falsehood, but it was the sole and last result of centuries and the age-long labor of human thought in that direction. It was the latest belief. It was the ruling conviction. And from among all other explanations, Levin, without himself knowing when or how, had involuntarily chosen it as being at any rate the clearest of all. But it was not only false. It was the cruel mockery of some evil power, a wicked and disgusting power, and one to which it was impossible to submit. It was necessary to free oneself from that power. The means of escape were in the hands of every man. An end had to be put to that dependence on an evil power, and there was one means: death. And though he was a happy and healthy family man, Levin was several times so near to suicide that he hid a cord he had lest he should hang himself, and he feared to carry a gun lest he should shoot himself. But he did not hang or shoot himself, and went on living. Chapter 10. When Levin thought about what he was and why he lived, he could find no answer and was driven to despair. But when he left off asking himself those questions, he seemed to know what he was and why he lived, for he acted and lived unfalteringly and definitely, recently even more unfalteringly than before. When he returned to the country in June, he went back to his ordinary occupations: husbandry, intercourse with the peasants and with his neighbours, management of his house and of his sisters' and brothers' affairs, which were entrusted to him, relations with his wife and relatives, cares about his baby, and a new hobby, beekeeping, which he took up with enthusiasm that spring, occupied all his time. These matters interested him not because he justified them to himself by any general theories, as he had done previously. On the contrary, being now on the one hand disenchanted by the ill success of his former occupations for the general welfare, and on the other hand too much occupied with his own thoughts and by the mass of affairs that overwhelmed him from all sides, he quite abandoned all calculation of public utility, and these matters interested him only because it seemed to him that he had to do what he was doing and could not act otherwise. Formerly, it had been so almost from childhood, and increasingly so till his complete maturity, when he tried to do anything for the good of everybody, for humanity, for Russia, for the whole village. He had noticed that the thoughts of it were agreeable, but the activity itself was always unsatisfactory. There was no full assurance that the work was really necessary, and the activity itself, which at first seemed so great, ever lessened and lessened till it vanished.
But now, since his marriage, when he began to confine himself more and more to living for himself, though he no longer felt any joy at the thought of his activity, he felt confident that his work was necessary, saw that it progressed far better than formerly, and that it was always growing more and more. Now, as if involuntarily, he cut ever deeper and deeper into the earth, so that he, like a ploughshare, could not get out without turning the sod. For the family to live as their grandfathers and fathers had been accustomed to live, that is, at the same educational level, and so to bring up their children, was undoubtedly necessary. It was just as necessary as to dine when hungry, and therefore, just as it was necessary to prepare dinner, so it was necessary to arrange the husbandry at Pokrovsk in such a way as to derive an income from it. As surely as one must pay one's debts, so surely was it necessary to keep the patrimony in such a state that when his son inherited it, he would thank his father, as Levin thanked his grandfather, for all that he had built and planted. To do this, he must not lease the land, but must farm it himself, keep cattle, manure the fields, and plant woods. It was as impossible not to look after his brothers' and sisters' affairs, and those of all the peasants who came for advice and were accustomed to do so, as it is impossible to abandon a baby you are already holding in your arms. It was necessary to look after the comforts of his sister-in-law and her children, who had been invited, and of his wife and child, and it was impossible not to pass at least a small portion of each day with them. All this, with game-shooting and his new hobby of beekeeping, filled up the whole of that life of his which seemed to him, when he thought about it, to have no meaning. But besides knowing definitely what he had to do, Levin also knew how to do it all, and which affair was the more important of any two. He knew that he must hire labourers as cheaply as possible, but that he must not take them in bondage for less than they were worth by advancing them money, though this would be very profitable. He might sell straw to the peasants in a time of shortage, though he felt sorry for them. But an inn or a public house, although it brought in a revenue, must be done away with. Felling trees must be punished as severely as possible, but if peasants let their cattle stray, he must not exact fines from them. And though it grieved the watchmen and weakened discipline, the strayed cattle must not be detained. He must lend money to Pyotr to liberate him from the usurers to whom he was paying 10% a month, but he must neither reduce nor postpone the payments of rent by the peasants who were in default. The steward must not be excused when the small meadow was not mown and the grass was wasted, but grass must not be mown on the 80 desyatinas which had been planted with young trees. He must not pardon a labourer who went home at a busy time because his father had died. Sorry as he might be for the man, part of his pay had to be deducted for the precious months during which he had been absent. But he could not neglect giving a monthly allowance to old domestic serfs who were of no use at all to him. Levin knew, too, that on returning home the first thing he must do was to go to his wife, who was unwell, and that the peasants who had been waiting for 3 hours to see him could wait a little longer, and he knew that in spite of all the pleasure of hiving a swarm, he must forego that pleasure, let the old beekeeper hive the swarm without him, and go to talk to the peasants who had found him at the apiary. Whether he was acting well or ill, he did not know, and far from laying down the law about it, he now avoided talking or thinking about it. Thinking about it led him into doubts and prevented him from seeing what he should and should not do. But when he did not think, but just lived, he unceasingly felt in his soul the presence of an infallible judge deciding which of two possible actions was the better and which the worse. And as soon as he did what he should not have done, he immediately felt this. In this way he lived, not knowing or seeing any possibility of knowing what he was or why he lived in the world. And he suffered so much from that ignorance that he was afraid he might commit suicide, while at the same time he was firmly cutting his own particular, definite path through life. Chapter 11. The day when Koznishev arrived at Pokrovsk was one of Levin's most distressing days. It was the most pressingly busy season of the year,
when an extraordinary tension of self-sacrificing labour manifests itself among all the peasants, such as is never shown in any other condition of life, and such as would be highly esteemed if the people who exhibit this quality esteemed it themselves, if it were not repeated every year, and if the results of that tension were not so simple. To mow or reap the rye and oats and cart them, to finish mowing the meadows, to re-plough the fallow land, to thresh the seed corn and sow the winter rye, all this seems simple and ordinary. Yet to get it all done, it is necessary that all the peasants, from the oldest to the youngest, should work unceasingly those 3 or 4 weeks, 3 times as hard as usual, living on kvass, onions and black bread, threshing and carting the sheaves by night, and sleeping not more than 2 or 3 hours out of the 24. And this is done every year, all over Russia. Having lived most of his life in the country and in close contact with the peasants, Lievin always felt at this busy time that this general stimulation of the peasants communicated itself to him. Early in the morning he rode to where the first rye was being sown, then to see the oats carted and stacked, and returning home when his wife and sister-in-law were getting up, he drank coffee with them, and then walked to the farm where the new threshing machine was to be started to thresh the seed corn. All that day, when talking to the steward and the peasants, and at home with his wife, Dolly, her children, and his father-in-law, Lievin's thoughts were busy with the one and only subject outside his farming that interested him at this time, and in everything he sought its relation to his questions, what am I, where am I, and why am I here? Standing in the cool shade of the newly thatched barn, with its wattle walls of hazel which had not yet shed its scented leaves, pressed against the freshly stripped aspens of the roof tree under the thatch, he looked now through the open doorway into which the dry and bitter chaff dust rushed and whirled, at the grass round the threshing floor lit up by the hot sunshine, and at the fresh straw that had just been brought out of the barn, now at the bright-headed and white-breasted swallows that flew in chirping beneath the roof, and, flapping their wings, paused in the light of the doorway, and now at the people who bustled about in the dark and dusty barn. And he thought strange thoughts. Why is all this being done? He wondered. Why am I standing here, obliging them to work? Why do they all make such efforts and try to show me their zeal? Why is my old friend Matryona toiling so? I doctored her after the fire when she was struck by a girder, he thought, looking at a thin peasant woman who pushed the grain along with a rake, her dark, sunburnt, bare feet stepping with effort on the hard, uneven barn floor. She recovered then, but today or tomorrow or in 10 years' time, they will bury her, and nothing will be left of her, nor of that smart girl with the red skirt, who with such dexterous and delicate movements is beating the chaff from the ears. She too will be buried, and that piebald gelding too. And that one, very soon, he reflected, looking at a horse breathing quickly with falling and rising belly and inflated nostrils as it trod on the slanting wheel that moved under it. They will bury her, and so they will Theodore, who is feeding the machine, his curly beard full of chaff, and his shirt torn on his white shoulder. Yet he loosens the sheaves and gives directions, shouts at the women, and quickly puts right the strap on the flywheel. And moreover, not they only, but I too shall be buried, and nothing will be left. What is it all for? He thought this, and at the same time looked at his watch to calculate how much they could thresh in an hour. He had to know this in order to set them their day's task accordingly. They've been nearly an hour, and have only just started on the third heap, thought he, approached the man who was feeding the machine, and shouting above its din, told him to put in less at a time.
You put in too much at a time, Theodore. Don't you see it gets jammed, and that's why it does not go well? Feed it in evenly.
Theodore, black with the dust that stuck to his perspiring face, shouted something in reply, but still did not do as Lievin wished. Lievin went up to the roller, motioned Theodore aside, and himself began feeding the machine. Having worked till the peasant's dinner hour, which soon came, he left the barn together with Theodore and began chatting, standing beside the neat, yellow, freshly reaped stack of seed rye on the threshing floor. Theodore came from the farther village, the one where Lievin had formerly let the land to be worked cooperatively. At present it was let to the innkeeper. Lievin got into conversation with Theodore about that land, and asked whether Plato, a well-to-do and worthy peasant of that village, would not rent that land next year.
"The rent is too high, Konstantin Dmitrich," answered Theodore,
picking out the ears of rye from the front of his damp shirt.
"But how does Kirillov make it pay?"
"Why shouldn't Mityuka, as he contemptuously called the innkeeper, make it pay, Konstantin Dmitrich? Oh, that fellow will press hard, but he'll get his own. He will have no pity on a Christian. But as if Daddy Plato would ever skin a man. He'll lend, and sometimes he'll let a man off, and so run short himself. It all depends on the sort of man."
"But why should he let anyone off?"
"Oh, well, you see, people differ. One man lives only for his own needs. Take Mityuka, who only stuffs his own belly. But Plato was an upright old man. He lives for his soul, and remembers God."
"How does he remember God? How does he live for the soul?" Lievin almost cried out.
"You know how. Rightly. In a godly way. You know, people differ. Take you, for instance. You won't injure anyone either." "Yes, yes. Goodbye," uttered Lievin, gasping with excitement, and turning away, he took his stick and walked quickly away toward home.
At the peasant's words about Plato living for his soul, rightly, in a godly way, dim but important thoughts crowded into his mind, as if breaking loose from some place where they had been locked up, and all rushing toward one goal, whirled in his head, dazzling him with their light.
Chapter 12. Lievin went along the high road with long strides, attending not so much to his thoughts, he could not yet disentangle them, as to a condition of his soul he had never before experienced. The words the peasant had spoken produced in his soul the effect of an electric spark, suddenly transforming and welding into one a whole group of disjointed, impotent, separate ideas which had always interested him. These ideas, though he had been unconscious of them, had been in his mind when he was talking about letting the land. He felt something new in his soul, and probed this something with pleasure, not yet knowing what it was. To live not for one's needs, but for God. For what God? What could be more senseless than what he said? He said we must not live for our needs. That is, we must not live for what we understand and what attracts us, what we wish for, but must live for something incomprehensible, for God, whom nobody can understand or define. Well? And did I not understand those senseless words of Theodore's? And having understood them, did I doubt their justice? Did I find them stupid, vague, or inexact? No. I understand him just as he understands them. Understood completely and more clearly than I understand anything in life. And I have never in my life doubted it, and cannot doubt it. And not I alone, but everyone, the whole world, only understands that completely. Nobody is free from doubt about other things, but nobody ever doubts this one thing. Everybody always agrees with it. And I sought for miracles, regretted not to see a miracle that might convince me. A physical miracle would have tempted me. But here is a miracle, the one possible, everlasting miracle, all around me, and I did not notice it. Theodore says that Kirillov, the innkeeper, lives for his belly. Oh, that is intelligible and reasonable. We all, as reasoning creatures, cannot live otherwise. And then that same Theodore says that it is wrong to live for one's belly, and that we must live for truth, for God. And at the first hint, I understand him. I
And millions of men who lived centuries ago, and those who are living now, peasants, the poor in spirit, and sages who have thought and written about it, saying the same thing in their obscure words, we all agree on that one thing, what we should live for, and what is good. I and all other men know only one thing.